I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. Learn about the wonderfully tart Montmorency cherry at choosecherries.com.
HRN is offering complimentary business memberships to 50 Black, Indigenous, people of color-owned food businesses this summer. The deadline to apply is July 31st. Each business membership, a $500 value, is an advertising opportunity that will allow businesses disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 to connect with HRN's listening community and promote their work. To apply and review the terms and conditions, go to heritageradionetwork.org/biz.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm your host, Kathy Irway. So it's June right now, and you might be growing this season. I know a lot of people who are just starting to garden for the first time. Maybe it's a result of boredom from stay-at-home orders, or maybe it's just, it seems like the right time because you've gotten into cooking and then you wanted to explore the step before that, which is growing the food. And I gotta say, I have a great little, I don't have any land, unfortunately, but I have a great little windowsill garden and fire escape garden here in Brooklyn. So I'm really excited to share a book that will give you, and I don't want to say fodder or food for thought because it's so overplayed, but it'll give you a lot of ideas. Let's say compost to feed your gardening projects. This book delves into the culture, the history, the science, and the many uses of one crop in particular. And it actually recently won the James Beard Award in 2020 for nonfiction books. So I'm really excited to talk with its author. His name is Chris Smith. The book is called The Whole Okra. And Chris is also the executive director of the Utopian Seed Project, which you can check out at theutopianseedproject.org. So welcome to the show, Chris. How are you?
Happy. Very good, thank you. Happy to be here.
Great. Awesome. So if anyone just sort of noticed your voice, it may have shattered the illusion that folks may have had of like a benevolent Southern farmer or perhaps cook or seed saver who is obsessed with okra. But that's not the case. Instead, you are a British guy, a white British guy.
I am a white British guy that came to the South and fell in love with okra and ended up writing a book on it. It's a bit of a strange journey, but here I am.
It's amazing. I loved your story about it. If you could tell folks a little bit about why you got, obsessed with okra, I'd love to hear.
Yeah, for sure. So when I first came to America, I began working for a small seed company in Asheville called So True Seed. And so I was a gardener and a seed saver and that kind of thing. But there's so many things you can grow in the South that you can't grow in England. You know, we have a reputation for, I think, cabbages, maybe. So it's way more exciting to be growing stuff in the South. Mm-hmm. And as a wedding present, somebody gave me and my wife an okra pod. It was a dried okra pod full of seeds. And they gave it to us because we had traveled to India and loved the cuisine and that kind of thing. But as a gardener and a seed saver, the seeds in that okra pod came with this story about where she had grown them and got the original seeds from and where those seeds had come from. And so as soon as you get into gardening and saving seeds, then you realize that there's this wonderful heritage that goes with them. And so I received those seeds and really felt a strong obligation to keep growing them and to continue the story of that seed. And that was kind of my my intro into having this real positive experience with okra that was otherwise kind of unknown to me. I'd had one previous experience on a trip to the South, which was not a good experience. It was the stereotypical slimy experience. But once you grow something yourself, then you get to engage with that food on a whole different level. And that began the journey of my okra obsession that led me to this point today.
That's, yeah. I gotta say, Chris, I once grew some okra, some red okra, and it really surprised me. And I'm not like, you know, I'm not really an expert on it at all, or growing anything really, but I went away for a couple weeks and someone was supposed to water and didn't, for whatever reason, water the okra. And I came back and it had dried, but also it had grown woody and dried and split at the tip so that it was like, it burst open like this macabre, like tiger lily with like in the most amazing way. And I put it in a vase and it looked like perfect for like a goth wedding. But, you know, I was like, wow, okra is a crazy, crazy plant.
Yeah. You don't get to have that experience with the plant when you just buy it in the supermarket, right? You just see that small green pod. But once you grow it yourself, then again, you get to interact with it on so many other levels, and the plant itself is quite stunning.
And it's interesting because you do mention that a lot of people don't, you know, bother to check it out for a second time or even a first time because it has such a reputation for being unpalatable, right?
That was almost, I grew it myself and enjoyed growing it and thought, wow, this crop is amazing. But then I would butt up against this negative reaction. I go to a lot of agricultural conferences and the reaction would always be, not always be, the camps are split into people that truly get okra and love it and grow it and eat it and all the good stuff. But then there's the polar opposite as well. People that just entirely dislike it.
That's something that is also mentioned by Michael Twitty, who wrote the foreword for this book. Michael Twitty is also the author of The Cooking Gene, A Journey Through African-American Culinary History in the Old South. And he is mentioned throughout the book, as well as many other African-American writers and, you know, food writers like Jessica B. Harris and so forth. In fact, you mentioned that Jessica B. Harris said that whenever okra points its green tip, Africa has been, and the trail of trade evidenced by the presence of the pod is formidable. So getting into like the history of okra, you write that it almost certainly landed in the U.S. through the ports of Charleston and New Orleans in the 1700s. And now before it had sort of begun showing up in South America in the 1600s. But the idea, and Leah Penniman, an author and the author of Farming While Black, you mentioned, she said that, you know, researching this, she found that her ancestors would even braid rice, okra, and millet seeds into their hair as an insurance for an uncertain future. So that would be, you know, Africans who were enslaved and kidnapped and taken to America. And, you know, that's the idea that we have of how the okra seeds crossed the Atlantic and came to America. But others, you write, have been skeptical of that. Like Michael Twitty had some other theories on who it was grabbing the seeds. But, you know, tell us what you think the research points you to when it comes to the most likely way the seeds came over and why.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm necessarily qualified to truly speak to one truth or another. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that probably all the above is correct. People throughout time have really valued seeds, and seeds are a massive part of their culture and their heritage. And I totally understand and believe that people knowing that the slave trade was happening and people were being abducted all along the west coast of Africa would go to extreme lengths to preserve that cultural heritage by braiding seeds into their hair and having them survive the Middle Passage. Michael Twitty's point is that there are manifestos from the ships that show that the people that were abducting people were also abducting their crops so that mm-hmm. when they were trying to establish colonies on the backs of slave labor, then they were able to feed those people their cultural foods. And it was a very intentional, malicious, horrific thing that mm-hmm. happened. They were treating it as a business in people, and what better way to trade in people than to also bring along the food that they eat. So it was kind of a very, horrible thing to read about, but something that we really need to realize that it was engineered to be that way in a very clinical way, and that they profited from that by being very clever with the way that they were trading in people. Mm-hmm. So that's a reality that is documented. So that's the two things that exist as how it got here. And I kind of fully believe that both could have happened.
Yeah.
But for the quantity and the speed with which these crops were established west of the Atlantic, then it's pretty clear that this slave ship owners were also bringing across the crops as well as the people.
I see. Well, you know, it's interesting. And I don't know if you've heard of the Okra Project. It's been going around in the news a bit lately.
I have seen that cropping up. I came across that in my research and checked them out, mm-hmm. and love that. In fact, I've just rushed back from Asheville. There was a Black Trans march that was happening in Asheville that we wanted to attend and support, and mm-hmm. it was and just this morning another friend emailed me that project, so lots of people have been making me aware of it. But I'd come across that a few years ago, and love what they're doing in terms of food security and helping out on that level.
Right. And it's interesting that they have chosen okra as like a symbol for this group. And, you know, just for folks who haven't heard of it, it's the Okra Project is supporting Black trans people. And it's supporting this community, which has historically been marginalized, ignored, and mistreated. And through food, through nourishing, healthful meals that it is supplying. But I think the idea is that the analogy of the okra seed traveling to provide some sort of hope, right, for those who traveled with it for a better future.
I haven't spoken to them directly, so I wouldn't want to speak for them, but the analogy definitely makes sense, like okra as a food of sustenance and hope. And I think in many ways, when we look at the enslaved people, they weren't allowed, they were prevented from reading and writing and learning to read and write, but they were allowed to have their own gardens. And so that's where we see some of these, what we call traditional southern crops, mm-hmm. got established in a lot of these gardens, things like collards and southern peas. And okra were grown as sustenance. So that was one of the few liberties is the wrong word, but you know, the mm-hmm. few things that were allowed to happen. And obviously, again, that was another slaveholder intention. It wasn't a gracious thing. It was like, well, if you feed yourself, then you can probably continue to work. I can't imagine it was an act of benevolence to say, hey, yeah, go on garden so that you can feel good. I doubt that entirely, but but they were allowed to have their own gardens and grow these crops.
Well, that's being reclaimed and subverted, hopefully, with embracing okra. Of course, in this book, you know, I think it's interesting that you dedicate a whole book to a food that is so maligned today, from a culinary perspective, at least. So you start out by saying, you know, when the first like fried okra that you tried was sort of given to you as a joke almost, because it was thought to be so off-putting. But
actually I started my presentations, and the working title of the book was In Defense of Okra, because I was shocked by how many people truly didn't like it or didn't get it. And I wanted to kind of push back against that to some extent. And this was probably began on in some level of ignorance. I didn't really know or fully understand its entire history or even its entire potential. But I knew from my beginning experiences that it was a crop with potential, and I wanted to speak more to that. And that's why I don't ever describe myself as an expert, because I really don't think I am. But I'm certainly an enthusiast, and I've certainly learned a lot about it and want to share that knowledge and encourage people to respect the food's heritage and also embrace that as a food potential, crop potential going forward.
Right, right. So just so folks know, this is not just a history book. This is, you know, the whole okra is explore how to use, and like so many surprising ways to use this crop, this amazing crop. From, you have chapters dedicated to the slime, the pods, the flowers, the leaves, and the seeds. And I mean, there's stuff I've never heard of, like okra seed flour, okra fiber paper. So I'm curious, at what point did you realize that okra was just so fascinating and multifaceted and versatile that you just had to learn more about it?
It wasn't really a light bulb moment. I've always been curious about using the whole crop, because it takes a lot of effort to grow something. So you might as well, you know, maximize what you can get out of that crop. So I'd always been curious, and pretty clearly early on, it was like, oh, the flowers are edible, and oh, the leaves are edible and they have protein, and oh, you can press for an oil. And it was more of like a rabbit hole. I researched and read and discovered and went deeper into like 1800s agricultural texts or more recent university academic papers. And the more I dug, the more I found the more could be done with okra. And I don't think I got to the bottom of the barrel in this book. In the couple of years that it's already been out there, or 1 year, I guess, then I'm still learning. People are still reaching out to me and saying, hey, did you know, or what about this? And I'm discovering new things all the time. So I think okra's got a long way to go. And I think other crops that we grow and just assume that you can only eat the tomato and not realize that the tomato leaves are also edible. You know, this happens across the vegetable garden. We just focus in on that one primary crop and ignore the potential of all the food that's actually out there.
Wow, that is so true. I mean, I hope many people who are just now starting a garden, maybe they find their okra and share those discoveries with us to come.
Yeah. And also it's not really a discovery. I didn't really discover anything. Everything had already been discovered, more or less.
Maybe
the okra marshmallows I made up, so that was a new thing that nobody else had heard of.
Wait, did you say okra marshmallow? Go on.
Another author friend, Katrina Blair, wrote a book called The Wild Wisdom of Weeds, and she investigated the wild mallow plant, which she made marshmallows from that plant. And I reached out to her and said, hey, I'm writing a book on okra. Do you want to do something crazy with okra? And she, literally weeks after, she mailed me a box of okra marshmallows, which were chewy and delicious and had a little bit of the green okra flavor, but were sweetened with honey. And really, that's kind of like the secret weapon. You have to carry them around in your bag. And when people say, ooh, I hate okra, you have to, you hand them one and they eat it, and then they have to take it back and say, actually, okay, okra is pretty good.
I love it. I love it. Well, we're going to talk a lot more about some of those secret weapons and more after a quick little commercial break.
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. A cherry isn't just a cherry. When it comes to tart cherries, the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry variety is the cherry with more. They're available year-round, dried, frozen, canned, juice, and concentrate. U.S. Montmorency tart cherries are also one of America's superfruit, which means they're good for you. Tart cherries contain many antioxidants and beneficial phytonutrients, including anthocyanins, the pigments that give tart cherries their bright red color. And don't forget about flavor. U.S. Montmorency's unique sour-sweet profile make them an excellent addition to yogurt, oatmeal, salads, trail mix, and of course, a classic cherry pie. Learn more about the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency Tart Cherry at choosecherries.com.
All right, and we're back chatting more with Chris Smith. He is the author of The Whole Okra, and this is a book from Chelsea Green Publishing that came out last year, and it is the winner recently of the 2020 James Beard Awards. It is subtitled A Seed to Stem Celebration. So, Chris, we were just talking a little bit about the history of okra, how it got here. I want to talk more about varieties, but taking it back for just one second, tell us a little bit about what you do at the Utopian Seed Project, which you are the director of.
Yeah, so it's kind of fun because the Utopian Seed Project grew out of my explorations with okra in, and it sounds like we'll talk about it briefly, but in 2018, I grew 76 different varieties of okra as a large variety trial and to play around with all the different things you could do with okra. And that kind of generated a lot of excitement in our community. I was working with local chefs and local businesses to do all sorts of things like okra flower tea and okra seed tempeh and okra pod kimchi and you know, all these really fun things that you can do with okra to really celebrate it as a food. And there was a fair bit of publicity came out of just that single project. That So True Seed, the company that I was working for, the seed company, I managed to persuade them to let me set up the Utopian Seed Project kind of on their time to take that idea of exploring varietal diversity and celebrating all the different food potential and sustainable agricultural potential with lots of other food crops. And so that's kind of the basis of the Utopian Seed Project, is this kind of excitable exploratory organization that can do a lot of hands in the dirt farming and crop research, and then taking that research and sharing it with chefs and local businesses, and really celebrating and educating around those crops and the diversity that's on offer in the farming systems, or could be on offer if we were to embrace some of this varietal diversity and crop diversity and that kind of thing. So it's really an extension of the okra, which is kind of a fun evolution.
And any other crops that you're working on right now?
Oh my gosh, so many crops. We've kind of broken it down into different focus areas because there's so much to go at. We're pretty excited this year at growing tropical perennials as temperate annuals. So that's taken a whole bunch of things like taro and ube and yacon and oka and mashua and all these other tropical root crops that you can grow in this region as annuals.
Cool.
We're continuing the exploration of southern food crops, the diversity in southern food crops. So we've now trialed over 150 varieties of okra,
oh my
over
goodness.
50 varieties of southern pea. We're starting to get into an heirloom collards project that we're working on in collaboration with a few other organizations like Seed Savers Exchange and Southern Exposure Seed Exchange and Working Food Group in Florida. It's kind of a much bigger collaboration to really explore some of the diversity and heritage and history. Another, you know, fantastic African-American food crop in the South.
Wow.
So yeah, lots to go
this
at, which
is
pretty fun.
Amazing. I'm just like browsing around here and there's like, you know, the cowpeas and black-eyed peas, conch peas, all in the southern peas category. And then, of course, beans,
huge
category.
Yeah. And we're kind of actually, we've grown way more than is represented on our website. We've got a bit of an admin lag. But we're pretty active with keeping up to date on our trials through our Instagram feed. And then we'll get it all on the website as a kind of a reference research so that farmers can look at the varietal diversity, or chefs could say, oh, I really want to work with that southern pea because it's got a delicate flavor and works really well in this preparation. You know, we're doing a lot of culinary evaluations as well.
Fantastic.
Which is really fun.
Yeah, so you guys can follow that at Utopian Seed Project on Instagram. And are you guys okay with the pandemic, and you know, has that affected your work?
Well, we feel pretty lucky because we're not a market farmer, so we're not relying on that income. We're set up as a nonprofit. So we you know, we have a Patreon account and we have some good supporters that way, and we have some family foundation money helping us in these first few years. So fiscally were pretty stable. We were relying on a lot of events. We do culinary events and trial to table eating events and that kind of thing to get our work out to people. And obviously most of that is closed down. But we're in the growing season now. So most of the current work that we do in this season is in the field. And that's mainly me and a small group of volunteers. So we're able to socially distance quite easily. Going into the fall, it's going to be a little harder because that's usually when we start doing more of these food-focused events, and we're not going to be able to do that. But we'll
do more of these podcasts.
Yeah, precisely. We're able to do videos and podcasts and obviously get stuff on the website, and I think we'll still be able to achieve our mission. It's just always very powerful to sit around a table and share food. Last year, we did a okra taste test. We had 48 different varieties of okra, and we did the same taste test in three different North Carolinian cities with chefs that we invited in to trial all these different varieties and try and establish which ones tasted better. So those types of events just aren't realistic at the moment.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, that's so exciting. Which one does taste the best?
Oh, I try and avoid the superlative, but in those particular trials, then one of the ones that came out was ranked really highly in all the cities was this variety called Aunt Hetty's Red. It's a beautiful, deep red variety that everyone thought tastes really good. It's got great texture and productivity. One of my board member, the chef's farmer, he's called Jamie Swafford. He's on the board and grew a lot of it that year and was selling it to Charlotte area chefs. And actually this year, Slow Food Asheville has taken it up as part of their heritage food project. And we've managed to get the same variety out to a whole bunch of community gardens and home gardeners to grow this variety and really celebrate it. It's a Tennessee heirloom, and I'm really quite in love with that variety. It ticks all the boxes. There's other really good ones, but I'm enjoying that one at the moment.
Wonderful. Is that the one on the cover, or am I seeing a few different red ones on the cover? I see you have this.
That's actually just one variety.
Okay.
But it had some kind of variance within that variety. That variety is called Sea Island Red. Mm-hmm. And it's awesome. Oh, and this is, you know, we could just speak for hours about okra varieties, but Sea Island Red is from the Sea Islands off the coast of Georgia. So it's part of the Gullah Geechee community. And there was a seed matriarch that lived on Sapelo Island called Cornelia Bailey. And she's sadly since passed away. But before she died, she gave some seeds of this okra variety to another friend at the University of Georgia called Sarah Ross, and she gave them to me and I grew them out. And it was a really good variety. But when the seeds arrived in my hands, they were labeled as Ethiopian red okra.
Oh.
And that really intrigued me because the domesticated origin of okra is the Ethiopian region of Africa. So I was like, well, are these like truly descendants of the original Ethiopian okra variety? And I didn't know how that could be because the okra that came across with the slave trade was West African okra. The journey is muddled, but Cornelia Bailey was dead at that time. And there was nobody, I've tried chasing down the answers and I haven't been able to find out why these seeds were labeled as Ethiopian okra when they came from Sapelo Island. And I would love to know the history of that. And I've since sent those seeds. I've grown them out and saved the seeds myself and send them back to Chef BJ Dennis, who's a Gullah Geechee chef down in Charleston, and Jovan Sage, who's down on coastal Georgia. And I really feel like these stories, I'm fascinated by the stories, but they're way more culturally significant to certain groups of people. And I feel highly obligated to get those seeds back to the people that really truly belong to
absolutely.
That's the Island Red variety is really a great variety, and I'm pleased that people are growing it back down in Georgia.
So the origin of okra, you were saying, is in Western Africa, or that's just the origin of most of the ones that are in the States right now?
Yeah,
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Okay.
It came across with the slave trade. And so right. okra is widely grown along those West African countries. And so that's where the North American okras came from. But okra's true origin is likely to be East Africa, and also probably has some heritage going back to India. Northern India has a lot of the wild relatives of okra, whereas East Africa doesn't. Mm-hmm. So it's disputed and unknown, to be honest. There's no actual factual answer, but India has a pretty good claim on the wild heritage of okra, and then the Ethiopian region of Africa has a pretty good claim on the domesticated region, the domesticated history of okra. So some sort of wild stock probably came from Asia, and then it was probably domesticated in Ethiopia, and then it traveled across Africa and was widely grown in West Africa. And then with the slave trade, it came across to the Americas.
I see. And it's widely enjoyed in India, where it's known as bindi.
Yes. Yeah.
And you were mentioning that you probably have eaten it in curries and, you know.
Yeah. Without knowing it. Yeah. Right. Big, England has a large Indian community, and curry and Indian houses are all over England. So it's a kind of a common food. I think chicken tikka masala is technically the national dish of England, which is silly because masala is just like a random mix of spices. So it's like a non-dish, but that's the way it's kind
chicken
of
chicken and spices.
pretty much, yeah. So yeah, okra has probably turned up in my life without me really knowing it. But I don't really count that as my first experience.
Right.
But India is the largest world producer of okra by a long, long way.
And it's very, I mean, it's not disdained at all, as far as I'm aware.
Well, that was my assumption too. I was like, it's so widely grown and eaten. But I interviewed an Indian chef who grew up just outside of Mumbai, Chef Marwan Irani, who owns a restaurant here in Asheville. And when I interviewed him, he had exactly the same story as Michael Twitty's story and so many other people's story about being a child that hated okra.
I see.
I think it's widely used as an accessible vegetable in their dishes, but there's still a whole host of people that dislike it. So there's something that goes beyond any cultural thing. That there's actually something that people really don't like about okra.
And it's mostly because of that slime. Is that what the childhood sort of like, you know?
I think so. I think it's a total texture thing. Yeah. It's, which some people grow to like or appreciate or learn how to cook it in ways that mitigate the slime. But and some people never get past that kind of stereotypical, terrible vegetable level.
Well, what's one great use of slime then that you would suggest to? I see there's all kinds of, you know, okra cosmetics around the world.
yeah, people are using it for that. It's very rehydrating. Again, as with so many things, okra that can be traced back to African origins. There was a Zimbabwean tradition of using okra in face masks as a rehydration kind of skin, healthy skin thing.
I can see that. A peel or something. Yeah.
But from a culinary perspective, the famous one that nobody really thinks about, it's kind of like everyone hates the slime until they need to use the slime, and that's gumbo. You know, it's the traditional thickener of gumbo, and that slime really binds it all together. The way that I don't see how anybody cannot be convinced by this, Virginia Willis in her book Okra, which is a recipe collection of okra recipes, has a Nigerian black-eyed pea and okra fritter, and she minces up the okra pod to make it into this gluey mass, and then mixes in like scallions and black-eyed peas, and I forget all the ingredients, but basically it's the okra slime that's binding that whole patty together, and then you fry it and you get this crispy, crunchy, delicious, real fresh tasting, because it's got no flour, no eggs, it's just bound together by the okra. And so then Vivian Howard, in her book Deep Run Roots, which is a Southern food cookbook, she has a similar recipe, which I forget what she calls it, but it's like a summer vegetable patty. And again, it's minced up okra. And then you just put in like fresh corn, scallions, maybe red peppers, like all these crunchy, fresh summer vegetables.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And it just sucks them all together. And then you fry it in little patties. And it's again, just, it's like a real healthy taste of summer that's only bound together by the slime. And you don't, you don't think slime when you're eating it, because the high heat kind of like just makes it all crispy and delicious.
Cool. There's so many fun uses. I love how, you have the voices of Virginia Willis, who we love. We've had on the show a couple times, as well as Sandra Alex Katz, our fermentation guru, who says that this book is filled with interesting stories and great ideas for using pods, flowers, and more. I mean, there's a photo of you in this book with okra hair gel or conditioner that's giving you a look that looks like Edward Scissorhands a bit.
Yeah.
And and then I love the idea of this, the older, woodier pods can work really well for the body scrub too. So
it's crazy how, like, some of it's kind of crazy creative, but a lot of it's just like real, you know, if you're homesteading, if you're gardening, if you just want to really think about maximizing your garden use, then it's really just a creative exploration of all the useful parts of the okra plant, which every part of the okra plant is useful and usually edible. Like most of it's an edible application.
Right. Of course. Yeah. I mean, but this is just, it's so expansive that, you know, it, and I love how you incorporate all these voices of folks who have studied some of these uses before and cooked with it, of course, like Virginia Willis.
Yeah. I think that speaks to the fact that I describe myself as an expert okra enthusiast, not an okra expert. And I think that's key to just me being true to my journey with okra, but also, you know, okra has this history that is way before and beyond me. And I don't think I could have written a book about okra with any level of integrity without including those voices. Those voices are the ones that can speak to okra's cultural roots, and those recipes are true to them in a way that I love okra and I feel a kinship with okra, but can never be truly true to me because I grew up in England where it's just not a part of me on that level. So, you know, I'm sad about that, but that's the truth. And so the best way to address that was to really bring in this wide range of voices to help tell those stories.
Yeah. And I love how, you know, you mentioned you didn't even get to the bottom of all of it. There's so much more that there could be another whole book, it sounds like, about okra.
I'm blown away by that.
Fascinating.
How far it could take us.
Well, you know, one random gift for a wedding has taken you through such an amazing journey through okra. And thank you so much for sharing it with us. It's really, really fascinating. We didn't even get through, like, you know, we just kind of barely scratched the surface of this book. But Chris, I do have to ask one more thing to just kind of settle the score, you know. So can you call a dish a gumbo if it doesn't have okra in it?
Now we've just leapt into controversy. there's been whole books written on gumbo, and I'm sure people will fight about it. But I think you can, because there's been an okra and gumbo. It's part of it, like an evolution. It doesn't need to be a this or that. And certainly, I think the idea of having a thickened soup or stew with okra was like the beginnings of that, but it's evolved over time. And there are plenty of examples of thickened Creole style, Louisiana type, soupy stews that have full claim to gumbo in their own right. There's legitimate, uses of powdered sassafras, the fillet, as a thickener and being called gumbo. And I like I read a lot about this to try and get to the bottom of it.
Okay,
and
yeah.
Maybe it's an unsatisfactory conclusion, but like all those claims seem to be, they have relevance. They have historical documentation. The argument seems to come about like which one came first. And really, you know, I don't necessarily, it's probably important to some people, but I'm like, this I take it from the other viewpoint. I'm like, oh cool, I can use powdered sassafras leaves to thicken a soup.
Yeah.
I can use okra to thicken a soup. I can do this, I can do that, or I could just make a roux and that's enough to kind of have this more modern style of gumbo. But yeah, people have written way more and researched way more on gumbo than I have, and they've come to the conclusion that gumbo is this whole diverse hodgepodge of things, some of which will include gumbo, okra.
I love that because, you know, it's an evolving, yes, cuisine is evolving. And so is okra and seeds in any plant that we eat. So I like that answer. Thank you. And it looks like that's about all the time we have today. But I really hope everyone gets their hands on the whole okra and treats themselves to just a fascinating journey that you have put together here for everyone to enjoy. And folks can follow along your journeys and continue journeys with it at the Utopian Seed Project.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Great, and thank you so much for joining, and thanks everyone. And Jeet, our engineer here at Heritage Radio Network, we'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Eat Your Words is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.